State your name.
My name is Lorraine Brissett.
And your address?
I'm from the Kettle and Stony Point Reserve.
Okay. Do you want to give a local address?
572 Colburn Street, number 7.
And phone number, both at home and work?
Work, 672-0131. No home phone number.
Date of birth?
5th of May, 1959.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
And Kettle and Stony Point is where you were born?
Yep.
Just out of curiosity, I know we talked about this when I interviewed you, but do you do any crafts yourself? Are you involved in any kind of artwork or crafts yourself?
No, very little. Very little.
Tell me what your position is at NAMRND and what your job description would be. What is the expectations are for you here?
Last July, I was hired here at the NAMRND Friendship Center as the community development worker. Basically, the responsibilities are to be community responsive, to help community members identify their areas of needs and interest, and help them to develop programs and projects that they feel are necessary to achieve whatever their goals might be. The center is here to help facilitate special projects and programs for community members. We do not initiate them. We only help the process of helping community members help themselves. Community development, personal development in terms of if someone wants to, a group wants to learn facilitation skills, if they want to learn how to be a chairperson, if they want to learn how to be a good committee member, a board member, then I'll take the task of giving them that training. If it's group progress that they want to engage in, then as a group, I'll work with them as a group to help identify the goals and objectives, come up with a methodology of how they hope to achieve their goals, and the implementation process of helping them to achieve what they've identified that they want to achieve.
What specific workshops, programs, whatever, have you been involved with since you started with NAMRND?
Last July when I started, the one project specifically was given to me, and that was the Ojibwe Language Committee. At the time, a submission had been made to Secretary of State to form an Ojibwe Language Committee of London and to schedule a series of classes. So when I came, there was nobody that was already doing that. The proposal had been written. There was actually no community members assigned to be a part of that committee. So my job, being a new person to the London area, was to meet people and encourage them to become active community members as a part of the Native community. So in recruiting new people that I had just met, and then giving them this task of coming up with terms of reference for Ojibwe language classes, it was rewarding to myself as well as to, I think, some of the committee members that we have involved today. I should say that through personal contacts with Carolyn Oliver and her husband Ken, who took a very responsible role within the Ojibwe Language Committee in helping to keep it together and keeping the classes moving, we had over 75 people register for the Ojibwe Language last fall. We had over 45 graduate. And 25 were between the ages of 5 to 14, and the rest of them were adults. So that indicates to us that program was a success, because parents were giving their support for children to learn about the Ojibwe language. Some of the students were from the Oneida Reserve, and even though we weren't teaching the Oneida language, they still consented to their children learning the Ojibwe language, which is, you know, a native language in itself.
How long have you been able to do this type of work?
I have worked with Indian people since I started working, which is, I could say, probably 12 years that I've dedicated to working with Indian people at a local level, a community level, a regional level, and a national level. Probably a personal interest and a personal belief. Number one, that I believe if you see there are changes that need to be made, and specifically to the Indian Act, I felt there were a lot of changes that needed to be made. I didn't like living under that type of regulations. And my plan of action for my own life was to become a part of the solution. And by achieving becoming part of the solution was to get into politics. And to get at a level, to reach a level that I could help influence the policymakers. So rather than just sitting back and complaining about what I can't do, I thought I'll get into the field of work where I can gradually move up and become a part of that policymaking level. So that was a personal interest. And another interest was I believe that I have skills and abilities that I can lend to and dedicate to the commitment to my own people. I will always work for Native people.
When you first started working, what are some of the other kinds of jobs that you've had in the past?
During my high school years, I lived on a cattle in Stony Point Reserve, and every summer since I was 14, I held jobs on the reserve, either in a capacity of recreation researcher, recreation director. We had our own business. My parents owned our own business, so I became very versed with small business operations. Doing miniature community needs assessment, community studies. And from these summer school experiences, or from these really these early experiences in my life, it gave me an appreciation of the importance of community work, how important leaders in our community really are, and how active they should be and how responsible they should be in communicating effectively with community members. A community isn't necessarily just a group of people living together. That demographically, that's a community. But in terms of real living, a community is only a vital, thriving community when there's effective communication flowing through it, where everyone understands the local government, where everyone understands and appreciates the importance of certain bylaws, of our regulations. And at an early age, I was very fortunate to work with people who were very dedicated to community work and helping individuals, and in turn those individuals become future leaders, which I've seen, and just from one family to another, just by word of mouth, you gain community support. And when it comes time to vote on something, everyone has a thorough understanding of why you're doing it, what the benefits are, and have an appreciation for it, and can give their vote with confidence, knowing what they're voting for. And I guess at that age, I also decided that I wanted to become a band counselor. I wanted to have impact. I wanted to make impact on the policies that were affecting my life on my reserve. And after I finished high school and went away and worked for a while in Toronto, then I moved back to my reserve and I ran in our local election, and I was elected as a band counselor. Probably, I was the youngest Native woman on our reserve to become a counselor, yes. And I was a very vocal one. And I caused a lot of changes, and change is not easy. Change is very difficult. There's a lot of opposition to it. But at least it was introduced, and I believe some changes were made for the better. And I enjoyed it. It was very challenging and very rewarding.
I'll bet that you were probably wondering, how old would you have been then? Because you're only about 28 or 29 now, right? Yeah, so you had to be probably the youngest in Canada. You have to get in the Guinness Book of Records to find that out.
Yes.
That's fascinating.
Probably the mouthiest too. No.
Is that why you took it along so well?
No.
At the end of the vaping, I want to ask her a question. Hold that thought. I've got it down. As long as you don't ask me. Okay. You've talked about the language classes that we run here. Have you set up any other kinds of workshops as part of your job with NAMRND that had to do with any other area of cultural preservation or craft work?
A nature walk back in September. And we asked interested people to sign up with us. And I took them out to Kettle Point to look at the various herbs that were growing at that particular time, the different kinds of roots that you can pick. And I think Carolyn came along with us on that trip. And it was interesting. It was all kind of new to a lot of the people that were on the nature walk. And it was interesting, and I think it was a good exposure to our community members that there are still people down on our reserves that still practice traditional medicines and still use them. It's very, very much a part of their life still. As well as NAMRND hosted a basket making workshop back in October, and Rachel Shawkins from Kettle Point held a basket making workshop for 2 days, and that was very well attended, and it was really nice, and I think most of the participants really enjoyed it. One other major event that we've had back in March 21st and 22nd was our annual powwow. And again, we asked members from our community to be involved, to volunteer their time to become a part of the committee that planned it and organized it and actually put it on. And we had an excellent response rate. We had over 20 people sign up to be as committee members. And at every meeting, we had no less than 12 people. And to me, that's excellent. That's excellent. And out of that, people learned, I hope, good facilitation skills, good chairmanship skills. And NAMRND is no longer the planning body for that, but this committee functions independently now, or as before it didn't. So that's progress to us, because the community is taking control for themselves of events that they want to have.
What's the cultural significance for you of having regular powwows?
The cultural significance to me is giving the opportunity to urban Indians to get together with non-urban Indians and share their experiences in dance, in beliefs, in values, in food, in crafts, just in every aspect of our culture. Because the two value systems, I think, are a little bit different. This is the values to a non-native, to a non-urban Indian, as to an urban Indian, I think are somewhat different.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What you see as some of the differences?
One of the major differences of an urban Indian that has never grown up on a reserve is they have no appreciation for the extended family. I don't care whether I really see my aunt or uncle. Like, you know, I see them once a year, that's okay. Or they may say, well, yeah, I see my grandma, I write to her. But there's no urgency in them to visit and to make contact, to keep regular contact, regular communication, to be really concerned about that family. Whereas someone that has grown up on a reserve realizes the importance, the significance, and the benefits of being a part of the extended family. And you would just never find anyone that grew up on a reserve saying, oh, I don't care about my grandmother. Oh yeah, I see her once a month. You know, I think you'd find it very hard to find somebody like that. Someone on the reserve is very close to their family. Our ties are very strong. We're bonded together, very strong. And our communities, that's what makes our community so strong, is our family support for each other. And we invite outsiders to come into our communities and to visit. We don't exclude them. It's not like we hate them when we see somebody come on the reserve. It's just an interesting aspect to see somebody come on the reserve and want to visit or want to learn about our culture. And at first, I think there's a bit of apprehension. It's a little bit of hesitation to communicate with them. But once you talk with them for a few minutes and find out their motives are genuine and sincere, you know, they'll invite you in for a cup of tea and sit down and talk to you. That's one difference that I've noticed between urban and non-urban Indians.
What about in terms of preservation of customs, ceremonies, craft work, language? Is there a difference between urban and non-urban?
Urban Indians don't have the opportunity to participate in a sweat lodge. There are no sweat lodges in a city. Urban Indians don't have the appreciation of self-government, of self-determination, of having programs that are Native-specific, of having programs that are Native-controlled, of having programs that are community-based, or having programs that are Native-determined. It's kind of, we're part of the system, they think we're part of the system now. We should integrate. We should not try to separate ourselves. People like myself realize that we have a very unique difference from non-Native people. We have a heritage that we're very proud of. We were the original peoples of this country. Our grandfathers, our grandmothers, our great people that have gone before us have paid a very dear price for what we call culture. And a lot of them died trying to preserve our culture. And growing up on the reserve reinforces that value system. People that have grown up in a city have no appreciation of that value system because they have already integrated themselves into the system. They don't see a need to preserve. Why preserve? I'm getting along just fine in the city. I don't need it. But when you're living on the reserve and you have parents that went away to school and said, and were told in the boarding schools, you know, don't speak your language. And then you're living on the reserve and your parents tell you don't speak the language and they won't teach you the language. You're wondering why? Why aren't you trying to preserve our language? You find out the history and have an appreciation behind it, and it gives you a desire to fight even more to preserve it. And it's interesting, at least from my viewpoint, the differences between urban Indians and people that have grown up on reserves.
One of the things that I've noticed in doing the interviews is, and it's certainly not a random sample, you know, there may be some selectivity here, but is running into a number of women who have not been, who may have spent a few years as a young child on the reserve, but basically have been raised off reserves, and in their 20s, 30s, feel a passion, an absolute passion, to go back and reclaim. And they don't take any of it for granted. And I don't know how widespread that is, but there certainly is some evidence of that, that sense of having been separate from who they were for a period of time and needing to go back to claim it. But I don't know how much of that you see.
There's some part in your life as a child where you lose it and you come back to it. It even means a lot more to you. But the interviews that we had done, from what I gather...
Thanks, Gail.
From the interviews that we had done, from what I gather is that on the reserves, from what we're getting, is the people on the reserve from the areas we've already interviewed, a lot of them don't know their own crafts. A lot of them
the family connections are there, but some of the cultural stuff
is not.
Is not.
And this has been through, most of the ones that we visited already, most of the ones we interviewed already, the family is close. As Yerbanians are though, they still feel about their family like they would a long time ago. The only thing different is that they live in different areas now. Like a long time ago, the Indians used to be travelers, and they're still like that today. They still pack up and leave, and a lot of times they don't know where your family is going to be right at that time. But then, because they have no alternative but to not contact their family all the time, because it costs money if you go back to see your mother. It costs money if you phone. It costs money. So a lot of times you don't have no alternative but to maybe go see them maybe once a year, even though you would like to see them every day. But because of the fact they're not a status and they can't go back to live on the reserve, I don't think that the person don't care and they're not close. They are still close. It's just the idea that
it's a definition of how you interpret close as to how I interpret close. Mm-hmm. Close is not the same to us. Mm-hmm. They have different meanings. And I don't think all these urban Indians are going to be welcome back to reserve either. There's a resentment from our on reserve Indians. They don't want these people back. You made the choice to go, Mary. Stay off the reserve.
Yeah, but then I feel that in that case where that's happening, I think that because they made that choice, because of the time that it started, at the time that it began, I could understand the reason why they made that choice. Years ago, if they married a white man, they would bring that white man onto the reserve. This is going back in time. If you really, talk and listen to a lot of the older people, they would tell you the same thing. Regardless what that person done, even if it was bad, they would still bring that person back, and they would treat that person as a human being and part of their lives.
I think the value system has changed a lot, though. I have no appreciation for that now.
Because they say they talk about traditional, they want to be traditional. How can they be traditional if they can't afford to open that door and welcome that person back into their lives? Even if it's their own relative. If it was their daughter married a white man, and she came knocking on the door, "Mom, I'm hungry, or I'm starving, I can't afford to feed my kids." You mean that mother's going to close that door on that family just because she married a white person? That's not right.
No.
If you're a traditional person, you won't care if that person is black, white, purple, green, or blue. You would open that door and welcome them in. I would. If I didn't like what my sons did, if they married a black woman or a white woman, even though I didn't appreciate it, I would still have to treat that person as part of my life regardless, because that's part of my son's life. That's who he chose to live with. Maybe I wouldn't have chosen it.
I don't think banned governments share that viewpoint, though.
But I think the only reason why is the fact that it's government. Everything has to do with government. It all boils down, and it all centers around government. Without that government's funding, the reserve wouldn't make. Welfare wouldn't be existing on the reserves. I think it doesn't matter where you go, you're still going to find it.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to take time for people to change their attitude towards non-status people to come back on.
Sure it's gonna.
You know?
Sure it's gonna.
Like, I would fight for it. I don't believe that self-government is right at this present moment, but I would fight for it because that's what the majority of the people would want. But for myself, I don't believe in it right now because they're not ready for self-government.
No.
You know? Like, I would like to see a change where we're able to say, yes, we can do this, and yes, I'd like to see this. But because we don't have that choice to be a self-government, you have to get off of welfare. You have to get off of government funds, government grants, government loans. You have to start doing things for yourself. That's what self-government is about. It's not being on welfare and living on a reserve and having everything handed to you. It's not being in the city and living on welfare and